Welcome to the audio podcast of The Table at Central United Methodist Church. The podcast currently features the messages of Matt Smith and Linda Du Hirsu,
with a musical introduction by Brendan Lowe, our director of music. Thanks for listening. When Herod died, an angel of the Lord suddenly appeared in a dream to Joseph in Egypt and said, "Get up, take the child and his mother, and go to the land of Israel, for those who were seeking the child's life are dead." Then Joseph got up and took the child and his mother and went to the land of Israel. But when he heard that Archelaus was ruling over Judea in place of his father Herod, he was afraid to go there. And after being warned in a dream, he went away to the district of Galilee. There he made his home in a town called Nazareth, so that what had been spoken through the prophets might be fulfilled: "He will be called a Nazarene."
Maybe some of you have heard, or you're new and you haven't heard yet, but we have a new preschool that is sharing space with us here at the table. The name of the preschool is Artenia Beast Academy of Whimsy and Play. And if that isn't enough to make you want to go there yourself, just walk down the hall. And, you know, we practice pastoral confidentiality, but I will say so many of you want to spend the night in that loft area. So, yeah, it's such an engaging space of whimsy and play. What it also means, though, is that I'm making a whole host of new friends in the 2 to 4 year old age bracket. And they are fabulous. They're just fabulous, my new friends. They are very dramatic, and they are very emotional. And they are very, very real. And this week, on one of the days this week, I parked back here and I drove up. It was around 10 in the morning and I was greeted by them. They're in the play yard. So now they're getting to know me. So, you know, you get out of the car and you're like, "Linda's here." I mean, how happy does that make you? Very happy. Especially when you take your teenagers to school and they're like, "Bye." So, right? I know. So we love each other, but, you know, so it's back to that 2 to 4 year old joy where I can't really do that much wrong. And this week, when I drove up and they greeted me, I noticed, though, that one of my friends was, like, totally crying. I mean, she was totally crying. She was not just crying, like, crying. She was crying, and she had her hands like this. And her teacher was holding her. And I'm like, "What's going on?" And, I mean, really think about that. There's crying and then there's... Well, the garbage truck was going to come. And the garbage truck scares her. She's very uncomfortable with the garbage truck. Now, I told you it was 10 o'clock in the morning. Garbage truck's not probably coming till around 1. But she was already upset about this. My children always look forward to the garbage truck coming. I mean, like, we race out to sit and watch the garbage truck do its thing. But this little person had something else going on with them about the garbage truck. That's because the imagination of children is really, really deep. And I actually think it's something to envy and to behold when it's in action. Who would think that a garbage truck could really terrorize you? But then again, as I said, who would think that a garbage truck could be your best friend of a mother that would entertain your child so you could take a shower? Right? It's both and. Part of the secret that children hold is that they engage without having to be told all of their senses. All of them. And they have not yet learned how to view the world around them as like a backdrop or like just scenery that you walk through on your way to doing something else that you're really intent on, and so you miss everything that you walk by. Here's an example. A lot of us have walked down our hallway right here in this church, and we have door stops that are in the ground, They're only about this tall. And I've told this story already because it happened this week, and I've told so many of you, but I'm still in it. They're only this big, like off the ground, and they're on the edges, right? So it doesn't seem like they're in your way. So the children come down the hall to go out to the play yard, and they hold hands in a human train, and I happen to be standing there, and I watched one. Just bit it. Then she bounced up. Walk some more. Next one. And then the group stopped because she stayed on the ground this time. And what was she doing? She was examining that doorstop. Who would think of a doorstop as something to smell, to taste, to touch? I know. And her friends just stood around her and waited, as did her teacher. While she explored the doorstop. See, having given themselves to the experience of the whole world, children haven't yet learned that they have to remove themselves and think, that's a tripping hazard. Could you get someone to remove that between now and next Sunday? Really? Children are beautiful. A writer this week reminded me about that beauty and possibility of apprenticing yourself with children. I didn't realize how much I was missing that until lately. Because when you apprentice yourself with children, especially in that age range of 2 to 4, you kind of realize that the world, again, is full of wonder. And that nothing is simply ever what it seems. Like a doorstop isn't really just a doorstop. Maybe it grew out. Maybe it's a plant. We wondered about that. It's packed, these things in the world, with endless possibilities and meaning. So, just one more example, not of our kids, but you know what a comb is for. It's for combing your hair. But some people see it as a musical instrument. Did you know that? If you put tissue paper over it. But children aren't even so limited by that. A comb becomes something to find seashells with at the beach. Or better yet, it's actually a tool for making racetracks for ants. Did you know that? I learned that. Yeah. To enter a world in which a comb is a tool for making racetracks for ants requires that we surrender our certainty about knowing what everything is for, how it is to be used, and what you're supposed to do. So just hold that as I ask you, have you ever had a dream and you took courage and told someone about it, and they just look at you and they dismiss you with, you have such an overactive imagination. It was just a dream. Get back to reality. The Epiphany, the season that we're in, is a season in which we hope to get a sense of what God imagines for us and what God dreams for us. Epiphany calls us, really, into wonder and to dreaming. What does God want for me? What does God want from me? Some of us want to know this so badly that the wondering ends up keeping us awake at night. And it becomes, instead of wonderment, it becomes anxiety and worry. What am I supposed to do? Who am I supposed to be? How am I supposed to live? And our dreams turn from wondering to nightmares because we are so intent on problem solving and making things happen that we don't allow God's creative power to work through our imaginations and wonder about things like doorstops and combs. So all that is to say, the reason I'm really saying all this is in order to work with this passage that Matt read for us this morning, we are going to have to use our imaginations. Already, we have traveled from the Christmas story to where we are today, And the Magi and then Joseph have hardly, if you get our drift, had a night of rest, because they're just dreaming and dreaming, as far as I can tell. And they accept guidance from their dreams. And Joseph especially has taken care to lead a pregnant teenage Mary to an out-of-the-way manger in Bethlehem in order to give birth to her son. And we have nativity scenes all over that have been shared through the ages, because we know that other people have wondered, what did that look like, too? From there, Joseph dreams some more, and we travel with the Holy Family into and out of Egypt. And Matt covered that last week. And we've been given lots of details through the biblical accounts. So it's easier, I think, in a way, to imagine those scenes. And if it isn't, we heard clearly from our friends at Tubman House, who helped us to really know the harsh reality and the events of Jesus' day, as well as our own. So what's next this week? Well, the gospel writer of Matthew is building towards his explanation of why Jesus was raised in the north and not in Bethlehem, where he was actually born. According to Matthew, Joseph discovers in his fourth dream that although Herod has died, Herod is the ruler, his equally oppressive and evil son, Archelaus, had been placed in charge over Judah, where Joseph had been heading, and making that southern region too dangerous for the Holy Family. Way too dangerous to take a child. To underscore that his change of residence was preordained by God, the writer of Matthew invokes this prophecy, which really, scholars say, he's the only one that found it in the book of Isaiah, chapter 11, 1, which declares that Jesus' eventual residence is going to be this northern city of Nazareth, identifying him as a Messiah and a branch of Netzer. And it's a play on words, Nazareth and Netzer. I know I just lost a whole bunch of you. Why is that even important? Really, it's okay to wonder that. Well, there would have been no doubt if I said everything that I just said in the way that the people who were in Matthew's time, when they heard that, they would have had no doubt that that meant Jesus was more a citizen of Galilee, viewed by many as a kind of bad place to be from, than he was of Jerusalem or Judah. And if he was from there, they would have expected different things. But all of that is really lost on us. It doesn't resonate with us, but it did to them. So listen, let's try this. Let's try it this way. Yeah, it's Jacob. If we want to legitimate a leader today, and we want to think of how we might say it to all of you as someone who's a rising star, we might say it like this. Well, I think this person really has potential. This person was born in Atlanta, Georgia. This person went to Morehouse College, pastored a church in Montgomery, Alabama. And you might start making some connections if you're a student of American history at all. See what I mean? I haven't said who that might be, but I've given a history which might give us more legitimacy to a person. If I gave that biography as an introduction to all of you, you might think, wow, I'm going to listen to whoever it is that comes next. So that's what Matthew's trying to do, is legitimate Jesus as the Messiah for all of these new folks by locating his home in Nazareth, where Joseph has taken him to raise him. And Joseph, he's been through so much. I just imagine them arriving finally at a place they can call home, and I imagine him thinking, phew, we have made it over the worst of nightmares. We are here. So what's going to happen next? We don't know. You heard that passage. There's one small piece in the book of Luke, but we're in Matthew, that talks about Jesus being taken as a young person to the temple. But really, from chapter 2 in Matthew to chapter 3, suddenly he's an adult. An adult. The writer of Matthew brings us from birth to what we heard this morning, and then there's this huge gap. So we're going to have to use our imaginations to wonder about this time. And that's not always the most comfortable thing for adults, now is it? What's more comfortable often is for you all to just be told. You want me or Matt or someone else to just tell you the truth of what happened or what scholars say happened. But imagining and wondering and dreaming, guess what? That's part of being a person of faith and searching scripture. It's a gift we've been given, but we just let go of that gift too soon, in my opinion. So what do we dream about what life was like for Joseph and Mary and Jesus? Did he settle in? Did he settle down? Did he raise a creative child? Is it nature or nurture? We wonder. There's a novel called The Moviegoer. It's old. It's by Walker Percy. And the main character in there is this guy named, he's got a great name, Binks Bowling. And Binks loved to go to the movies, and he imagined himself being part of the movies. And he had this phenomenal sense of what could happen in his life, seeing himself among the paparazzi and the stars. But there's this line in the novel, he says, I even dreamed that not that I would just be there, but I would do something great with my life. But there is much to be said for giving up on such grand ambitions and living the most ordinary life imaginable, a life without those old belongings. So then that makes me wonder, is that what it was like for Joseph? Who could blame him if he wanted to live a life without those old longings? Who could blame him if he settled in Nazareth, looked at Mary and said, okay, enough with the dreams. We're done. We're keeping our head down. I'm doing the construction thing. You're going to be a mom. Do not listen to God anymore. Look where it got them. That could happen. A lot of us do that. I'm just going to take care of my little thing. I'm going to do good right here, and that's it. But somehow I don't think that's what happened. If for no other reason than the boy they raised was really an out-of-the-box thinker. And it's not to say that out-of-the-box thinkers don't come from parents who are in-the-box thinkers, but I think when you're an out-of-the-box thinker, sometimes you're raised by out-of-the-box people. But we don't know. We have to imagine. And when I do that, I imagine that Joseph did not go to all of this trouble just to arrive with a toddler whom he promptly ignored. I just don't imagine that. I think he raised Jesus with words like yes and can and will in the face of challenges and problems. I think Joseph kept having dreams that inspired him. I hear him saying, yes, this is a dream I had that worked. I think it could work again. I hear him saying, this is imaginary. I'm going to go with it. Besides, he was a carpenter. A carpenter can make table and chairs out of just some sticks of wood. Carpenters do amazing things. Instead of finding excuses to wake up and banish his night terrors, put his longings behind him, maybe Joseph just kept on dreaming, we can do this. We can make our children's life happier. We can keep our family strong, Mary. We can help our community to join together. We can offer grace and hope. We can reach in love. Maybe that's what happened. We celebrate another who had dreams like that this weekend. And you know who it is. It's Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. And while I am sure he had a host of both night and day terrors that kept him from rest, I know, and I think we all know, that he had a beautiful, inspired, and inspiring dream that all of us, would be free from the sin of racism and classism and discover that in our freedom, we would establish economic justice and freedom for all persons. In no small part, Dr. King based this on his children and our children. You see, our hope through all of our own terrors is that somehow, some way, we will find our way through and be saved. And this does not mean we lie down before the terrors. We can't do that. For as long as we have strength to fight, it's both our nature and our privilege to do that. Sometimes God's blessing does not come until the morning light, after a full night of emptying ourselves and wandering around in our dreams, being awakened, trying to go back to sleep and ignore things. Sometimes it's just true that our job is to struggle with the terrors and neither surrender to them nor run away from them until we have figured out the blessings that are in those terrors. And we know that in his letter from a Birmingham jail, Dr. King did just that. He struggled. He had questions. He had doubts. He had frustrations at those who would tell him to slow down, to wait, to even stop what he was doing for another time. We heard that also from the wonderful women of Tubman House last week. They did not give up on their dreams. They stood firm. Their names were Teresa and Lourdes and Andrea from Tubman House. What I loved among many things about last week is they wanted something more than what they had known. Something more than what we know is a scary place to go. And now that they have shared that with all of us, and if you didn't hear it, it's on the podcast, I venture to say that we might in this room want that for them now more than ever, too. See how that works? They wanted something more for their children than they had ever had themselves, and now we want that for their children, too. They wanted a home filled with warmth and support, a fresh start, a place to mend their wounded hearts. They didn't want those voices in their ears yelling that you can't do this to overtake them. And Maisel's words said, their heart said, yes, we will do this. Yes, we can, and yes, we are. Because they learned that being homeless is not just about having a roof over their heads and a pillow under their head. It's about knowing in your head and in your heart that you're a safe person, that you have safety, that you are loved, that you are held to the highest expectation of who you already are. That's what it's like to follow Jesus, see? It's not just about going to church and checking that off a list. Following Jesus and practicing our faith is about knowing in our heads and in our hearts that we are loved and held by God to the highest expectation of who we already are. Who we already are. And when the odds feel stacked against us in so many ways, like they were stacked against Mary, teenaged and unwed, like they were stacked against Joseph, what did he have to endure standing by Mary in public and to keep his commitment to this betrothal? Stacked against Dr. King in our country, which is filled with white racists and run on white racist power. That's our country. And run on white racist power strategies even. In a day when it was illegal to sit wherever you wanted to sit and eat wherever you wanted to eat. And cowards ran around in white sheets and burned crosses on lawns and much, much worse. The odds feel stacked so much against so many people who are in generational poverty or against the nations of generational hate and violence. It's all over and around us. And even with the right words and the right willpower, our dreams sometimes do feel a bit fragile and frail beside all of that. And that might overwhelm us and scare us. Because if the dreams we offer the world are rooted in the same human frailties as those who struggle to achieve power for power's sake, we're really in trouble. But like Joseph in the gospel text that Matt read, we have to dream. We have to be God's dreamers. And in that narrative, under all of those ancient layers, what we can hear maybe is that Joseph simply heard God's call in his dreams and responded by putting that call into action in his life. The power of following his dreams transformed the motivation in all that Joseph did. He did not simply have a bad dream and run away from Egypt. He employed his imagination and implemented God's rescue. And this is when I go back to watching children. In another city, there's this preschool, and one of the teachers there keeps a blog. And if you want to ever go there, it's called teachertom.com. It's fabulous. And this week, he wrote a post about a book, maybe you've heard of it, called The Lord of the Flies. Okay? And we teach it in all of our schools. And how that story has always bothered him. And that's why it caught me, because it's always bothered me too. And the message in a nutshell in that book is that when we human beings are left to our own devices as children, we're going to become the worst that the human nature can become. And we're going to return to the laws of the jungle. That's what that says. And we're going to turn on each other in competition just to survive. And he wrote this blog post because this week at his school, some of the kids came back from winter break and they brought their cool new skateboards. And they, some had them and some didn't. So they added to the supply, the ones, the little scooter boards that the preschool had, but there weren't enough for everyone. And they went into their big hall, which is just like our big hall, and they let them play. The adults were there, and they let those children play with each other. And this is what he said about the experience. After our initial foray into adult control, that generally only made things worse, we found ourselves stepping back and sitting off to the sides and joining the games when we were invited in, but otherwise observing that the law of the jungle, at least our jungle, is actually one from which a great society can be built. I'm not saying there weren't conflicts. I'm not saying there weren't tears along the way, but instead of steps towards a burning island in need of rescue, like Lord of the Flies, the moments were part of a general movement of the children in the contrary direction, towards one another rather than away. They were instinctively exploring a path toward a cooperative existence, the way human nature tends when adults seek to support it happening instead of controlling it. So what can we do? It's a very fine line. It's very hard to know when to support and when not to control. Is it just a dream that we don't have to be like Lord of the Flies? Or is it for real? Living out our dreams may seem really silly to other people. But if we want a deeper faith and a full life, we're going to make the choice to dream and to dream big and to bring our scooters out and see what happens. But where do we start? Well, would you show that first picture, Ryan? I love this picture. It makes me cry. I love it because it's Dr. King and he's worrying about his son's tie. Right? And the other little boys may be crying, I don't know. And those of us who are parents know how hard it is to sit and have a frickin' family picture taken. But when this picture was taken, the world was different. And he, Dr. King, and those children did not have the freedom that we have today. That did not stop him, and it has not stopped us. But still, I just look at that picture over and over, and I imagine how the world they lived in still shaped and hurt them as they were trying to take courage. Now look at this next picture. It's harder to see. That's our president. And that's Dr. King, one of his grandchildren. Imagine this world now. She is on a stage with the president of the United States who looks like her. Almost. Women are coming. See? We dream big, right? She might think that. We can remember how brightly every day our life shines in small, fleeting moments like this. We can frame every day with the question, what do I love deeply and truly? And follow that, like Joseph did. We can bow our heads and call a night of healing sleep blessed. We can start each day awake and end it grateful. We can do one thing at a time and live that one thing really well. We can center ourselves in possibility and in trust, and knowing that impossible things just take a little more time to happen. But look, they happen. They happen. So Matt's going to help us now, and we're going to imagine some impossible things. I know you are already doing it in your lives and in your hearts. And we're going to move into prayer. And we're going to take a little time, not a lot, because we can do it all during the week.
We've come closer than we wanted. We've seen what we never should, and we will not be the same. We'll never be the same, no. Like steel, we are so resilient. Too much and we're weak as children. We were not meant to be made witness to these scenes, no. Oh. Oh, gunshots in a broken palace. Planes crashing and burn around us. It's different than it ever was. Darker than it's ever been. Three shouts and thank God I found you. With the crowd and the fog around you. I'll never let you fall. I'll never let you fall. Oh, heaven, can you hear us? Right now we are not sure, but I hope it will get better. These times we're in together, the change in us forever.